Welcome to Hacking Your Leadership. I'm Chris, and welcome to today's guest interview. Our guest interviews are long-form interviews with leaders from around the world. They've each been selected because of their valuable perspective on leadership and work they've accomplished in this space. Today, we're joined by Scott O'Neill, CEO of the Philadelphia 76ers basketball team and author of the new best-selling book, Be Where Your Feet Are, 7 Principles to Keep You Present, Grounded, and Thriving. Welcome, Scott. Say hi to our audience.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us. Chris, thank you for having me. I'm a listener.
Awesome. I love it.
And so I appreciate what you're doing to drive and help leaders just like me.
Awesome. Well, it's a pleasure having you. You know, educationally, your background is in business. Would you say that you are a business guy who found himself in the sports world, or are you a sports guy who found himself in the business world?
You know, when you grow up, I grew up as a kid in New York. I lived in Massachusetts, New York growing up, and sports became part of my life. When you get into this business, it just becomes very different. So some people ask me, like, how could you have worked for the Nets and then the Knicks and then the Sixers? Or how could you grow up a Giants fan, New York Giants fan, and work for the Philadelphia Eagles? And I'm like, it's your life. It's like, it's different from being a fan. It doesn't mean you're not as passionate, because you're actively more passionate. And it doesn't mean that you don't care. But you are a little more transient than fans. You know, some people, you know, I have a brother who's a huge Knicks fan. And, you know, the Knicks were playing the Sixers in a big game. And he's like, I'm coming to the game. I'm like, not in a Knicks sweatshirt, Jorn, buddy. You know, I'm like, this is my life. Like, this is my livelihood. You know, it's kind of funny. So, but I guess I consider myself a businessman who is very passionate about the power and influence sports can have in bringing people together. I think this summer, with the social injustice and the pandemic, I think I felt people isolated and alone and divided. And with our former president, the country was divided. And sports has this special power to build community. And you're rooting for something special to happen. And you turn into a kid. You jump out of your seat and you scream and yell. You know, just like when you go to a concert at the Brennan Center, you'd get up and dance, you know, and there are very few places you can get me to dance instead of a concert. And you don't want to see it. It's not a good sight. But I think the power and influence of sports is something that the world needs right now.
I completely agree with you. I think there was this kind of this mourning of sports when we started to realize last year sometime that it wasn't going to look like it did in previous years. And it was a mourning that I didn't see for other things, like not going to the office or not going to the movie theater or not going to, you know, at malls. You know, it's a different kind of mourning. And people feel that really strongly, even if you're not in a place where the fanaticism is high.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. The NBA and NHL both had bubbles. I work in both leagues. And so I had the opportunity to go down to the bubble in Orlando. And the bubble is what they call just a place where everybody was vaccinated and everybody was safe. You couldn't come or you couldn't leave or come in and out. And I was down there for a few weeks. And my first game I went to, I was the only fan. And can you imagine an NBA game in this day and age where you're used to going to these full arenas and fans going crazy? And I was there the only fan. And I thought, what? This is, I mean, and I love experiences. I love operations. I love watching, you know, how the NBA, which is an incredibly well-run league by Adam Silver. The next game I went to, in walks Bob Iger. Okay, so it's me and the CEO of Disney. The next guy to walk in is the commissioner of the NBA. So it was just like it was the most surreal experience. Like, going to a game by myself. Then the next time I look at, I'm like, Bob Iger? He's like, yes. I was like, I just read your book. It's incredible. It was a surreal experience. And you just got that sense that we needed it back then. Like, we needed it. I needed it. I go to games now, and we just got fans back, fortunately, in Philadelphia and in New Jersey with the Devils and the Sixers. And going to my first game with fans, I was just like happier. When I went to my games without fans, I was just like, it was like a mental health break. It was like, okay, I'm not on Zoom calls anymore. Okay, I'm not worried about the mental health of my employees anymore. Okay, I'm not like jamming leadership principles at a time when people just need a freaking hug or a break. And it is, I think, you know, all of us as leaders are challenged beyond what our reasonable expectations might have been a year ago. And I think that we're pushed into a place where we need to be different, a little more compassionate, you know, a little more understanding, a little softer. And I think sports brings some of those elements back in. I'm excited. Hopefully you sense my enthusiasm. I've been accused of being a tad bit too passionate at times, but I am really passionate about some things. And one thing is leadership. And the other thing is my culture, my people I get to work with.
I love that. I love that you brought it around to leadership, because this is a leadership podcast. So, you know, there are thousands of people in leadership roles who wanted promotions because it meant more money, more responsibility, et cetera. And they may have inherently understood that they'd be leading teams of people at some point, but that wasn't the driving force behind the passion for their upward movement. You've been vocal about the importance of talent and culture in the organizations you lead, and those are two things that really live and die at the hands of leaders. So how did that look for you? Did you know you wanted to be a leader, or did you find that love through doing it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have been a leader most of my life, for whatever that means. So if there's a sports team I'm playing, I was the captain. I wasn't always the best player, but I was always the person in the huddle saying, we need to do X, Y, and Z. So I had some of that. I was like the nerd who was running for class president. So I was that guy too. So so I have, you know, my folks, my parents are leadership development trainers. My dad's passed away. But so I grew up when I was 7 years old, collating books for them on team building and then quality and then, you know, and then quality circles. And so, and they consulted with Xerox and ADP and Texaco and my mom still does a little bit of that, but she's semi-retired. So I am a bit of a student of the game. I've got four siblings, three of them, including myself, are running companies. And so we definitely have like that, whether it's a gene or just we had it drilled into us from day one, we all kind of feel that. So, but I do believe leadership, can be taught. I don't think you're born a leader. I definitely think there are skills you can learn. I have some principles that may or may not apply. I'm interested in what you think about it, but I believe everyone's a leader. And I think you lead in the, you know, you bloom where you're planted, you know? And so, and you can be an incredible leader as an assistant or receptionist. Incredible. You can change the world. I have one of my daughters right now is playing basketball. And she is the ultimate leader. Now all my girls are very different. My three girls, my middle one happens to be like spot on incredible. They're all incredible in different ways, but she's the president of her class. She's captain of cheerleaders. She's student everything. You know, they have her on tours. She's just one of those kids that has this magnetism. When she walks in a room, she gets on this basketball team and she works really hard. She's just not that good. And so she doesn't play a lot. And my talks with her about like, think about how you can influence this team and think about like what I'm telling her. And it was very hard because she's 17 years old. And I said like, yeah, I mean, your friends are the best players on the team. They're best friends. I'm like, you know, one struggle. She misses two shots. She goes off the reservation. I'm like, think of how you can influence her in the huddle. I said, if the coach looks at your other friend sideways, she goes off the reservation. Think about how you can get her steadied. One gal struggles with her dad. If her dad shows up at the gym, she can't hit the bros out of the barn. I'm like, think how you can help her. So it's a great example to me in life, and you can apply that to business where, you know, the leaders are not, the CEO is not the leader. The CEO like exudes leadership and creates structure, hopefully provides a vision and a mission and directs the values. But, you know, in this day and age, we're all leaders. The world is so connected. You know, you think about I love millennials, by the way. I'm just I'm a millennial. I think I'm a millennial at heart. You know, I'm just an old millennial. But I always think about like they're running the world now because they're, you know, that group now has there a lot of them, and they're very influential in our workforce. And we have a very young group, young workforce. Our average age is probably, you know, 2,000 employees, average age probably 27-ish. So they're young. And they want some really simple things, right? They want access and they want transparency and they want to believe in something better than the mundane jobs they have. Those are the three things that I've learned that millennials want. And they want upper mobility. You know, they think they should be the president in 8 weeks. But for that, they're willing to work really hard. They are. And for that, like this group is really, really smart and really connected. And for that, they understand their brands way beyond what we understood to be a brand. I never consider myself a brand. And they walk out like, you know, they might as well be a first overall pick at 19 years old. They come in, they know exactly who they are. They know how to position what they want to position on social media to get X, Y, and Z. They're not afraid to ask for things. There's so many lessons that millennials are teaching us now that can help us be better. And I'm 50 years old. So, you know, and I consider myself a lifelong learner. And I'm learning all the time from millennials, but our environment is set up for them to thrive. And I think most companies now, I shouldn't say most because it's going to depend on what your workforce is, but if you're a workforce that has millennials, you really need to think about what you had pre-pandemic, what you had during the pandemic, and what's it going to look like post-pandemic. And there are three very, very different scenarios.
You're spot on with that. I think the millennial generation is probably more psychologically prepared to live in a world where you don't know whether you're working in an office or at home or at a Starbucks from week to week. And that kind of upheaval doesn't affect your productivity and your engagement as long as you are bought into the mission of the organization. And that might not be easily as said about other people who are other generations where a routine or a structure might be more comforting, more conducive to that productivity.
Yes, absolutely. I 100% agree with you. I would just say that they're much more in tune and sensitized to what's happening in the world as well. So for them, yeah, the work part, yeah, stick me in a Starbucks, I got this, you know? I can stay in my little studio apartment. It's all good, you know. But they have incredibly compassionate hearts, and they're incredibly concerned about being world citizens, and they're incredibly focused on things that are just and right. And that's what I've experienced. And so when we have the social justice debate, 60% of the focus goes there. When people can't get the vaccine because they're black, 30% of their focus goes there. And by the way, God bless them. Like, you know, this is the compassionate generation. Like, these are we will have a very different leadership look for this country in 15 years. And I think it bodes very well for us going forward. It'll be very different. And as a leader of a company who was banged into my head since I was 15 years old, there are two things you don't talk about: politics and religion. Guess what you need to talk about now? Politics and religion. And so it's hard, you know, it is hard. And so as a leader, we're trying to create an environment where we have stable mental health. And I think that's going to be the great challenge of leaders for the next decade. And I think the mental health challenges are way, way beyond what our capacity is to handle now. We have to kind of reinvigorate our culture and make sure that we are together, standing together as brothers and sisters. And we have to get back on track because some people have cut staff. Fortunately, we haven't, but you know, bonuses, promotions, advancement, shut down. And this is a group that wants to be president in 8 weeks. And so we've got to kind of take this whole ball of what they've seen and what they've felt. And we've got to create an environment where they're inspired, and there is no playbook for this. Like we are going on the fly, and as a mistake maker, you know, I think anytime you want to do something different, you got to be okay tripping and falling. I always say fail forward. It's kind of a core phrase of mine, and I fail plenty of times. There'll be another three today, I'm sure. But I will say as leaders and aspiring leaders, you need to really put some time and effort into things like, as I say, mind, body, soul, which nobody wants to talk about, you know? And I say, like, do something for your mind, something for your body, and something for your soul every day. That's my path to mental health. But and we talk about mind, it's easy. I always say, like, you got to read something, listen to this podcast, listen to a TED talk, read an article, do something other than your job to get a little smarter about something you're interested in, okay? Body's easy. You have to work out every day. You need to sweat. You got to, you know, whether that's a walk outside and that's fine, or whether it's a Peloton ride. I got on a Peloton strangely over this pandemic. And then the soul is one. It's harder to talk about these days. But for me, it could be scripture and prayer. But it could be yoga. It could be like runners get that runner high where you just like you need stillness. And so, like, if you told me 5 years ago that I would be talking about finding stillness, in your day every day. I mean, I just said you lost your mind. And right now, there's probably nothing more important than finding 10 minutes, putting on your Calm app or whatever you use to meditate and meditate. If you just told me to meditate 5 years ago, I'd have told you lost your mind. But like the whole world is moving at a pace where we as leaders need to get in front of it because we're responsible for too many people. And we have this opportunity and this platform to create an environment where people can thrive. And we're trying. I'm trying.
I think it's a profound answer. I think when it comes to the, you know, do stuff for yourself, you know, there's the old, when you're on an airplane, you put your own mask on before you help the person next to you, because if you're passed out, you can't help the person next to you, obviously. And I think that's so true. I think the things you're talking about are things that a lot of really successful people have already been doing for a long time. They just didn't talk about it as much. And we get the impression that in order to be successful, you have to move at this breakneck speed all the time. And that if you stop to take care of those things that you're talking about, you're somehow weaker, or you're somehow going to be left behind because you're not, you know, at the grind the entire time. And I think it's just completely wrong. And not just wrong in theory for an individual person, but the people who are successful have already know this, and they've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I also think there are things that we take for granted. You know, how you recharge your mind. Like, I vacation. I never apologize. When I have friends of mine, like, I haven't taken vacation in 10 years. I'm like, why wouldn't you take vacation? Like, we are grinding. Talk about a grind.
Yeah.
And we're working. And I've never met a successful person in my life that hasn't worked hard. I'm sure there is an example. Somebody bought Bitcoin at $3 and they put $100,000 in, and God bless them too. And by the way, I would love to do that. I don't think I have the gear, but I would love to be able to like get lucky or whatever that expression is. But for the rest of us, for the 99.99999%, like, you got to work. The question you have to ask yourself is whether it's finding stillness or taking vacation or setting down your Zoom and your phone, or sitting down for family dinner, whatever those things are, that's the recharge of your battery. I mean, and your body, my body cell, it needs it. And I always find myself, I come back from vacation and I come back refreshed with perspective and ideas. It's like, you ever that adage, this happens to me, bad visual, I know, but you know, in the shower, you oftentimes get your most clear thinking. You know why? Because there's no phone in there. We're actually, talk about be where your feet are. You are there. There's hot water coming down. Maybe do a little shampoo, a little soap, and that's it. You're clean and clear. We get in the car. What do? Turn on the radio. It's like, when are we getting that stillness time? That's the recharge. Our brains need it. Our bodies need it. Our soul needs it. And like that's the, I think the essence to a lot of what we're talking about.
Yeah, I'm a swimmer, and I swim laps every morning. And when I started doing this, I used to do it in high school and college, and then I stopped for a while. And when the pandemic hit and all the gyms closed, I thought, well, there's a pool next to me that'll let you rent a lane for $4 for an hour all by yourself. And so I started doing that. And naturally, the first thing I did is I went and bought a little MP3 player, put it underneath my my swim cap. And one day I forgot to charge the batteries and it was off. And it was really uncomfortable to just be in the silence of the swim. But within about 20 minutes, I went back to where I was when I used to do this competitively. And the benefit that I got from just being in my own head and allowing those thoughts to go through. And I never charged it again. I just don't use it.
I just
swim an hour and I just let myself think now. And that is more recharging than listening to rock music while I'm doing it and then feeling like I got the mind work or the body workout, but not the mind workout.
I love that notion. I actually, we have a pool out back and it's covered now, but my kids, would laugh because I would get on the bike and I would walk outside and I'd swim. And I can't swim. I mean, you sound like you're a real swimmer. Like, I can barely stay afloat in there. And for me, I would swim whatever, you know, the pool's probably 4 feet long. So I do whatever, 25 laps. So just literally touch and touch. But for me, it was peaceful. Like, I would get out and I would just hear the birds chirping. And I'm like, we all need to find that space. And whether it's like you walk into a gym, for me, you find a pool. For me, it's basketball. I hear the ball bouncing. It could be 5-year-old kids. I walk into the gym and I'm like, phone's in the back pocket, never comes out.
Yeah.
It's like you get in that pool, you're not looking at the phone, you're not listening to the music, you are actually letting the thoughts come to you. Man, it's a great story, great recharge.
Yeah, I love that. I want to go back to what you were talking about in terms of engaging the workforce, because as a leader, it's one of our, you know, one of our core responsibilities. I got some great advice from a leader a long time ago that has stuck with me and that I use whenever I am leading people. And this leader told me, she said that in every career conversation she ever has with anybody, it starts out with two questions. Do you know why this organization exists on the planet? And are you excited by that? Because if the answer to either of those two questions is no, then the rest of this is gonna suck. So why does your employer exist on this planet? And how do you make sure the people in your organization know why it exists? And how do you keep them excited by it?
Yeah, boy, those are complicated questions, but hopefully a simple answer. Like, we exist to leverage the platform to enhance the communities where we live, work, play, and win. So, I mean, that's it. I mean, it is like we are leveraging this incredible sport of basketball. We're leveraging the incredible passion of hockey to make sure we play in areas that are, shall I say, in need of help. You know, Philadelphia has the second highest poverty rate of any major U.S. city. What a gift to be placed in a position to be a steward of a brand like the 76ers, where I can reach people at a level that Comcast can't, University of Pennsylvania can't. And they're wonderful companies and they do wonderful things. But we have this passion point where we can reach kids. And so how we leverage that, that's why we exist, to make a difference to that 14-year-old kid, and hopefully give them some leadership, hopefully give them some hope, and hopefully give them some opportunity. And we do that in a lot of different ways. And the same thing in Newark, New Jersey, which is a really tough town in North Jersey. And we just built a world incredible training complex in Camden, New Jersey, which has an average household income of $13,000, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And so you have this, like, you have this platform, and I wish we could do it all. We happen to spend a lot of our focus on middle school kids, because we think they're at an age where we can help them. But we do what we can. So that is the reason we exist. I mean, I think what's hard for leaders, or I should say people running companies, is that you almost get tired of saying the same thing over and over and over, but you need to say the same thing over and over and over. And so, you know, we do the tricks of the trade, and we have, you know, town halls and quite a bit of communication. We have leadership meetings monthly, where we do leadership development with our top leaders, our top 100. And then we of course have our little, you know, they're called lunch and learns. Everybody has a name for them, but we essentially take our three presidents and I, and we have groups of 10 once a week, and we're trying to touch and reinforce. We also, it's going to sound hard the way I say it, but we require each person in the organization to give 76 hours of service to the community. And it's harder now just because it's hard to find service areas. But we would shut down the office once a month and go serve together. And I always say, like, you don't have to, because there's always like, well, I can't, I'm too busy. I'm like, yeah, you're all busy. I know. So life is hard. But I say, look, you don't have to serve with us. You don't have to go paint the school if that's not something that's important to you. If you'd rather go, you know, you sing holiday carols in an old folks home, go do it. You want to go mentor a kid, go do it. You want to go coach a team, go do it. But you have to serve and give in this community. So we push that agenda pretty aggressively, and I think it's resonated.
I think it kind of answers the second half of that question, which is how do you get people excited around doing that? And, you know, in the conversation around, you know, millennials and then now Gen Z coming into the workforce, those are the kind of things that naturally get people from those generations excited about coming to work, because they feel like they are doing something or contributing to something that is bigger than themselves or bigger than just whatever they're getting paid for. If you can make that a core principle of how you operate, I don't think you'll have much difficulty getting people to remain excited about doing that, even if they didn't really care as much about basketball as some other people.
You know, what I found as I've gotten older, you know, when I was emerging as a manager, leader, et cetera, in an organization, I treated everybody like I wanted to be treated, which is effectively like, okay, tell me what you need me to do, and leave me alone. You know, and that doesn't work. It doesn't. It's not a recipe for success. Some people, some of my managers are exactly like that. In fact, they wouldn't have it any other way, and I wouldn't have it any other way. And I had this awful line I used to say, you know, not everybody wants to play for Bobby Knight, but some people do. You know, which is an old adage to an old coach who coached for Indiana University for years and was a notorious screamer, yeller, and bully. Happened to be a wonderful guy for whatever it's worth, who I met a few times. But I don't want to play for that guy. But some people need to be kicked, and some people need to be hugged, and some people need to be nudged, and some people need to be kicked, hugged, and nudged at different times. And our job as managers and leaders is to figure out, like, what buttons to push when, so that people can become the best version of themselves. Not the best version that you think they are, and not the best version of you, but the best version of themselves. And what's happening, or at least what I'm experiencing happening with some of our emerging leaders, and we have extremely young people running big parts of the organization. I mean, we've got a president who's 32 years old. We've got who came up as a director. His name is Jake Reynolds, happened to have this incredible skill with hiring, developing people, and creating culture. I'm like, now this one we can work with, you know. And his team has kind of emerged up with him because he's hiring people in his likeness, you know. So they're extraordinary talent developers, extraordinary culture builders, and they've built this great. Now, how they turn that into a group that's diverse in thought and diverse in experience and diverse in approach is really hard for them. Because they know, you know, I would say if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. In this case, like, these guys have a formula that really works. I was like, yeah, but the world's changed. So now what? You know, so it's a really interesting, like, it's not, there is no linear path to becoming an extraordinary leader. I'm sure you see on this podcast, like, it's different. Like, and I thought it was. When I was young and people used to tell me, well, you have to fail. Great leaders fail. I'm like, I'm not failing. I'm going right to the moon. You know, as a 22-year-old idiot self. And I look now, I'm like, right. You know, you go on this path and you fall and you get up, you learn something. You say, okay, I don't want to do that again. And then you get fired. And you're like, how did I get fired? My results were X, Y, and Z. And then you think like, okay, what did I contribute to that? And then you run a company into the ground, which I did as well. And you think like, well, boy, it must have been the environment. No, it wasn't the environment. Here are four things I could have done differently. And here's what I learned. And then, you know, and you have something in life that goes bad. You have a miscarriage, we had a few of those with my wife, or you had, you know, a death in the family, or my best friend took his own life. And you're like, wait a second, this isn't supposed to happen. And I this notion that like everything is just on a string and it's gonna go perfectly well, it just doesn't work. And like the notion of the Brady Bunch isn't real. And we have to work. We have to work at everything, at our families. We have to work at our community. We have to work at our work. Every day, we've got to come in and say, like, I'm all in. I'm going to make my marriage work. It's important to me. I'm going to work for it. You know, I'm going to, you know, with my kids, that's the other thing. It's like you look on the outside, like, oh, what a perfect family. No. Doesn't exist. Okay. And my kids are amazing and I love them and they inspire me. Okay. And I've had challenges with all three of them in different ways, in different times, in different things, and some serious and some not so serious. And some of the stuff was because of my parenting, I'm sure, and my wife. And some of the stuff was they're exploring different ways to be who they are. And I just think, like, you know, as if there's one thing that I would love for your listeners to take away is that life is messy. Embrace that. When things go south, treat it as an opportunity to learn and grow. And to the extent that I can be self-aware of when I've really fallen down, fallen apart, whether that be in relationships or work or family or anything in between, it's like it's when I center on myself versus others and the world. And so to the extent that you can see the world for what it is, which is a pretty random mix of different people with different ideas and different thoughts, and they're going to be very different than your own and what your perspective is. And if you can put yourself out there in the world to treat them as people all the time and listen and learn, I think you're going to be better off in life. And it doesn't mean you're going to be better off today or tomorrow. It's like a young kid who takes a job at 22 and he sees like the jerk passing by or passerby. You're like, yeah, but don't be a jerk. Like, take care of people. Like, be wonderful to people. Be an extraordinary teammate. That's the expression we use at work. I always say, work unreasonably hard, be intellectually curious, and be an extraordinary teammate. If you do those three things, life's going to be pretty good for you. And it might not be good today, but you do those three things repeatedly, and over time, life's going to get really good.
I think that's incredibly profound. I love that. There are constant examples all over the place of people who, you know, you try to monetize everything. You try to like figure out, okay, if I'm going to invest time or effort or capital into this, what's going to be the return? And you might be able to make that happen for each individual thing. But on a long enough timeline, you're going to be far behind where people are who didn't care about what the return was on each individual relationship and just gave their all and put their heart into everything and helped other people. And sometimes those people are going to get burned. The person who wants to make sure everything's in line may not ever get burned, but they're never going to thrive the way somebody else is. Yes, you're going to get burned, but on a long enough timeline, the riches of self and of soul that will come back to you, and of monetary riches too, will typically be about as best as you can get if you just don't worry about the individual item and you think about on the long timeline.
I love the notion of that. My brother Michael, who runs this great company called Get Well Network, it's an interactive healthcare company, which he started from scratch when he had cancer. Actually, amazing story, but nonetheless, he always says time is the most precious resource. So when we're on the phone and we're starting to deal with that, he's like, okay, I gotta go. And I think he has a – it's hilarious. He's amazing. And I agree with that. I just think it's people or some combination of the two, because time is the most precious for sure, just because we don't have enough of it, you know. But people, for me at least, that's my jet fuel, you know. And so the notion of you know, being a 22-year-old kid as a marketing assistant – And looking around now and seeing some of those people now running really big companies and thinking like, I'm pretty glad I was friends with them when I was 22, you know, or, you know, when I was at the NBA, I look around and, you know, my team, we had a small Tiger team, but one of those Tiger team members is the president of the NBA now. And another one is the president of the Carolina Panthers. Another one's the CEO of the Detroit Red Wings, and another one is the president of the Sixers. And you think like, you know, I'm glad we were a tight unit. You know, it's just kind of funny. And it's like, you know, look, they're all incredible and talented. And you just think like, it wasn't Machiavellian when I was doing it and loving them and being friends with them and learning from them. And I think to the extent you can give and be on the, be that person. Be the person that's dependable. Be the person that's a wonderful ear that will listen to you. Be the person who will contribute and give. Be the person who people can rely on. Be the person who's trustworthy. Be the person who has high integrity. Be a wonderful friend. Be compassionate. Do those things always. And then when you get down the road, they're going to be exponentially more people who love you and root for you. And if you've done nothing else but put some goodness in the world, that they can put some goodness into someone else, life gets better for everybody. So I wholeheartedly believe in, like, I think some people call it karma. It's just putting goodness out in the world and that having like exponential rewards. And I even hate to say that, because I don't like I don't, networking, I'll use this as an example. People talk about, you're a good networker. I'm like, no, I don't even like the word. But you know a lot of people. I said, no, I love a lot of people. And I hope a lot of people love me. And I have relationships with even more people because I appreciate them. But networking to me has the notion of like, Chris, I know you, so if I need something, I'm going to call you. Or like, I know you because you have a great podcast. I want to get on. I was like, No. I have a lot of respect for Chris. Like he's excellent at his craft. Like he's influencing people, and that's important to me because that's important, you know, to my core of what I believe in, one of my core commitments in terms of leadership development. And so it's different. It's not so nuanced, and it's not such a line. And so you know, the notion of just treating people like people and being a good person. I know those are values that Andy Griffith talked about. you know, but they still hold true today. And I think that the more our worlds become digital and the more kinetic energy that's spun up in the world and the faster and crazier our lives get and the more information overload we have, the more valuable like those core values become, like the simple ones, you know, the simple ones that are about goodness.
Yeah, the word networking has been given a bad rap, I think, because, you know, there's what you're talking about, just inherently valuing people and caring about people. I think that's what networking was for the longest time. And then there were people who weren't very good at doing that. And then organizations came along and said, okay, well, the way you do this is you get in a room with a whole bunch of people and you kind of speed date and you go through it. And they turned it into a transactional relationship, and they got rid of the most important part, which is the relationship and the people, because they wanted to make sure even people who weren't naturally good at that could still participate. And over time, it has kind of devalued the word a little bit. And so I think what you're talking about is what networking really was always meant to be, because that's what leads to the real relationships.
You're so right. And I think if you go into quote unquote networking or relationship building with the notion of, I'd love to be of help. Is there something I can do to help you? How wonderful would that be to someone to say that to? Is there anything I can do to help you? That's a great way to build relationships.
Definitely. I want to get to your book, but I want to tease this question. You can answer it in just a moment. But I want to know what the impetus was. I want to know, so it's Be Where Your Feet Are. Was there a moment or a group of moments that made you say to yourself, I need to write this down? And I'm going to have you answer that in a moment after a brief word from our sponsor. All right, so we're here with Scott O'Neill, and I just asked the question what the impetus was for his new best-selling book, Be Where Your Feet Are. What was the moment or group of moments that made you think, I have to write this down?
Sure, it's not a happy moment, but I'm going to share it with you. So I had gone through a time in my life where my dad had passed away, and he was suffering and struggling. And it was from Parkinson's and dementia, and I was surprised that I didn't feel grief. I was praying he would die. He was suffering so much. And then about 6 months later, my best friend took his own life, unfortunately, and shot himself in the head. His name is Wilfred Carden, and he's a wonderful soul with a deep belly laugh, and he would light up a room with his presence. It's wonderful family, it's great, beautiful five kids. And I struggled. I spoke at his funeral and went into a total tailspin. Like, I'd never experienced that kind of tailspin before. And I started writing as a healing mechanism and started reaching out to my friends and saying, like, have you ever experienced anything like this? And I started to collect this incredible list of stories from people who are very accomplished and had suffered like an awful thing in their life. And so that's how it all started. And I began to write, ended up finding this incredible writer, Michelle Bender, who actually helped my writing become a book, because I am not a writer, but I have a lot of concepts and story. I'm a storyteller. And so the stories are about people who I know, some famous and some stay-at-home mom, to a Wimbledon champion, to a Night Shyamalan, who's a famous director, to David Stern, who passed away, my former boss and commissioner of the NBA, about some things and times in their life where they were up against it and they learned and got through on the other side. And so it was a passion project. I believe wholeheartedly in some of the things that they were going through, and for me, I have my own time in the barrel, if you will, and there's some real core principles that have helped me lift up and lift out. And so essentially the book has become a mind, body, soul meets purposeful living. I mean, that's the book, you know, and I think in this time of isolation, and we're all struggling a little bit, trying to figure out who we are and where we're heading and trying to find some purpose and make sense of what's happening in the world and get ready for whatever, however we define that new normal together. I think this book's a really interesting anecdote.
A mentor of mine, one of his kind of catchphrases is, wherever you go, there you are. And he uses it to remind me when I'm not where my feet are. Who came up with the title of the book? Like where did the title come from and what's the significance of it?
Yeah, it's something I have all these, you know, these sayings that will drive my children insane. One of them is Be Where Your Feet Are. And I use that with your phone. And I would say, are you where your feet are? Meaning, put your phone down. We're in the middle of a conversation. Stop texting your friend or get off of TikTok and let's go. And so we started to set up really around the phone. Okay. So I did it at work too. We have a table that sits at in every conference room, and that's a cell phone table. And so, and the younger, the millennials, it's where I take my notes. I'm like, grab a pen, you know? So I want to make sure that you are fully present, and whether you're at family dinner with me, that we're talking about your day and we're together and we're here. And when you're in a meeting with me, when I'm on this podcast, I don't have my phone up. I'm not checking my text while you're asking a question. I'm fully present with you. I'm where my feet are. I'm with you. And if I'm not with you, I shouldn't be here. I should say, hey, Chris, I got to check out. Sorry. This is good. I love you. This has been fun, but I got to go. I got something more important to do. My wife has a great line that she uses on me. And by the way, if you think I'm a perfect soldier in this pursuit, I am not. Okay. I'm in the pursuit. I want to be fully present and engaged all the time. And so my wife will say, I'll wait. And I was like, she's like, no, it's good. Is that more important? It's fine. Go do it. And it's a great tactic, by the way. It makes me feel so awful and small. And it does jump me back to reality very quickly. But the notion of being present today is harder than ever because we have distractions everywhere. You know, we talked about it a little bit before. It's like, you know, you're going swimming, your radio's on, you get in the car, turn on the radio. Radio, phone. You watch a show with your kids, okay? Flip on Netflix, put on your favorite show. One of my daughters and I are watching 100, kind of a dark, she's in dark shows, but it's a good show, dark show. But she will have that. She'll have her laptop up and she'll have her friend on and she'll like be half commentating the show with her friend who's not watching at the time. And she's either looking at TikTok videos as we do it or scrolling through text. I'm like, can you just be where your feet are? Let's do this together. And I think it's generationally, you know, the way the mind works, the way I understand the mind to work is like, it doesn't work. You can't multitask. The notion of multitasking is not real. It's like, it actually takes you longer to do everything you're doing when you think you're doing two things quicker. And I think it's going to wreak havoc on us in the future.
Yeah, I agree. I took some advice from someone, I think it might've been even Mark Zuckerberg a long time ago. He was in an interview and he said something to the effect of that he turns off his email notifications in the middle of the day. He checks email once at the beginning of the day and once at the end of the day and nothing in the middle, because what it does to your mind to have that ding go off and take you out of whatever it was you were doing to respond to that email. And you think of it as being, oh yeah, I can multitask, go back to what I was doing. But even just the few minutes that it took to switch your mind over, then switch it back, that adds up throughout the course of the day and you end up being a lot less productive overall. If it's something really, really important, and you have to know the people who would let you know that wouldn't do it through email anyway. They'd call you, and if that was a really big deal, then you get a phone call. If it's email, it can probably wait till the end of the day or to the next morning.
I love the notion. I have this executive coach, Brandon Bouchard, who's this brilliant leadership for high performance executive guru, and he told me that 60% of the highest performers. I'm sorry, the highest performers spend 60% of their time on the three things that matter most to their business. And I was just like, yikes. Okay. So the day before he told me that, I had gotten some notification from one of the email platforms and it said, your average response time on your emails is under an hour. Congratulations. And I was like, congratulations, or, oh no, get a hold of yourself, buddy. And so I know what I need to do, and I don't always do it perfectly. But I know in the book we talk about WMI, what's most important. And if you focus on what's most important, Stephen Covey used to say, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. You've got to figure out what you're going to prioritize at home and at work. And you're either spending time on those things or you're not. And you should consciously make that decision. It's a great little tactic is every week on Friday, okay? Go look at your schedule and just mark, print it out, one sheet for the week, and just mark what things you did and where you spent your time and how it related to the things that are most important. It will frighten you. I promise you it'll be below 20% and you'll be like, okay, I need to rethink and replan how I am going through life.
Yeah, it's got to be in hindsight too. You have to do it on the week after it ends, because if you do it going forward, you can easily schedule yourself to be at over 60%, but you know you're never going to do it. You know, you're going to move things around. So yes, absolutely. There's something about looking at yourself in the mirror at what's already been done, the time you can't get back. Did you put it towards what's most important? I like how your book is around storytelling. And I'm a storyteller myself. I love storytelling. It's one of the reasons I'm gravitating towards your book. And I'm not sure if you've listened to it before, but you know, the Tim Ferriss podcast is something I listen to sometimes. He had on Daniel Ek, who is the CEO of Spotify, a few months ago. And one of the questions was, you know, hey, what kind of leadership books are you reading right now? And he went through like a couple of the usual suspects that everybody says. But then he said something that I thought was profound, and it kind of stuck with me. He said that these days the inspiration he takes comes from leadership journeys more than the specific tools in the toolbox that you might have. And this is because you have to make leadership more personal. And you can't do that without storytelling. You do that with storytelling. And so what I'm wondering is, was that intentional, or is that just, that's how you know how to write, or how you that's how you can communicate yourself? Or was there a goal in structuring your book like a group of stories?
Good question. So I was never much of a speaker. If you know me now, you know, like, you could literally give me three bullet points and I could speak on, you know, the greenhouse effect. I remember I was just promoted at the NBA, and David Stern was the commissioner. He was a notoriously kind of nasty guy. And he calls me up, and you see that 8300 flash across your screen. And I still remember his extension, and it would terrify you. Like, literally the heat would start rising. He's one of those guys. He's like, you're presenting at the board meeting tomorrow. Don't screw it up. Although he used more colorful words and slammed on the phone. And I was like, uh-oh, first big speech. So now I'm speaking in front of, you know, 30 plus billionaires that own these sports teams. I'm a young executive, whatever, 35 years old. And at this point, like, I was old enough to know that I didn't know anything. You know, when you're young, you think you know everything. When you get to this age, like, I know, like, okay, I know what I don't know. So I get up and I'm reading a speech, okay, for 15 minutes, just like this. And I just read it word for word. Don't look up. I mean, it was as painful an experience as anyone in the room. Now, at that point, like, I still thought people were paying attention. But when you get older, you feel as, like, everybody's doing their own thing. It doesn't really matter. But I walked off. Before that, I had to go to the bathroom because I was going to throw up because I was so nervous. It was that bad. And afterwards, I walked up, and I had some of my dear friends who love me say, like, great job. And I was just like, nah, I'm never doing that again. Like, that's never going to be me ever again. And so I studied a bit. I'm intellectually curious. So I went and studied some great speakers. I read a ton. And then I started training my team on how to give talks. And I used to always say, open with a story, because they'll remember your story. And I think about the best talks I've ever heard, the best books I've ever read, the best articles I ever read. If you picture me on my hands and knees at the Ritz-Carlton throwing up before my talk, and then picture me on stage with sweat pouring down my face and me reading, that's gonna remind you, like, that's a better notion for me to learn, and hopefully for others to learn, than me to say, hey, you know what, you need better eye contact. Like, what's going to help you learn better? Like, for me, like, and I always said, you got to be vulnerable and you got to be personal. So there's a story in the book about this woman I work with who is a tremendous, her name's Laura Toscani. She had what she would call the perfect life. Married a star football player. She was a track scholarship. She was this big marketing director at 22 or whatever it was. And then had a baby, and something went really, really wrong. And so she held her baby, everything's fine. And then she had some really bad medical issues, and everything wasn't. And she's talking about, in the book, you read, she's just spiraling. Cuts off everybody, goes into her version of hell. And learned some really valuable lessons along the other way. Like, I don't know how you can teach that other than a wonderful story. About, and she's talking about, like, learning through failure or learning through falling. Like, I can say, you know what, when you fall down, you can pick yourself up. And she's like, yo, I was on the floor in tears when they walked in. And, you know, toxic chemicals are running into my son's kidney every day, and I can't stop it. That I remember. And then I remember, okay, therefore, then what did she do? And so I guess it's I guess conscious for one, and that's the way I learn. I think that's the way people learn. And if we want at the end of the day to help change behavior or influence people, you know, I always think if I'm ever in your role and I'm on the interview side or I'm talking to people on my town halls or in my daily life, I was like, okay, are they gonna remember one thing? Can I get them to remember one thing or change one thing or add one thing into their life or add one habit? You know, we've made a difference. You know, and you think about when I'm at church, and now church is all virtual, and my girls, they know when somebody's speaking at church, I'll say like, okay, did you notice the open? Did you see how they closed? Did you see how they kept it to three things? Did you see how they told a story and then drew it back so we could get got it. But that's how I think, you know, I think the best way to learn, and I'm interested in the way you think about it, but it's like you're telling me about swimming and you're actually walking me through the type of music you had under your cap. I'm like, okay, I got it. I have the visual. Now I understand. I'm going to find peace when I swim. I just think it's a better way to learn. I'm interested in your thoughts in terms of what you've experienced.
Yeah, so I think it's twofold. I think there's the mechanics of it that you're talking about. You know, they're structuring it a way to make sure that you activate people's brains in the way that, you know, physiologically they are more likely to activate. And then I think that's the science of it. Then I think there's the art of it too. And the art of it is that people are not going to care about anything you say until they care about you first. They have to care about you first. And the vulnerability that you're talking about bringing to a story, because it can't be a story about somebody else. It has to be a story about you. Because if it was just about the mechanics of it, it could be a story about other people. But it has to be about you, because you have to get them bought into you, and then they will buy in, or at least even be open-minded to buying into what you have to say.
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think, you know, this book is not a victory lap. I was telling my wife yesterday, I just said, because I'm calling my friends and say, hey, will you buy a book? You know, and I just said, hey, I'm glad this is not just me patting myself on the back. Like, I would not feel good about it. And she's like, it certainly is not that, because I just walked through like vulnerability after vulnerability and mistake after mistake and lesson after lesson, because it goes back to the notion we talked about earlier. It's like, those are the big learning points. Those are the big growth. My growth points are not from like, hey, I did this deal. Hey, I got this job. Like, it just doesn't, that's not how life, it's just not how I, what's that expression? You probably know it. Rough seas make great sailors. I totally agree with that. You know, I love that notion of just sharpening our tools every day, you know, like getting better, learning, growing. Being okay with the messiness.
There are a lot of people in your organization who are more public figures than you are, you know, who would be recognized walking down the boardwalk more than you would. But you're not nobody. And you would be recognized depending on where you went and who the crowd was. How did you balance wanting to put your soul into something like this with this notion that that we are inherently judged by people publicly, and you have a brand to uphold too. You represent an organization that you need to make sure that your stories represent that organization well too. And without selling yourself out and without not being vulnerable, not airing your dirty laundry, so to speak. How did that come to pass?
Yeah, that's a rich question. First off, when I get slaughtered in the media or in public or social media or the media, it hurts. Like, I was so surprised when I got fired. I was president of Madison Square Garden, got fired, and I read about it everywhere. And I was hurt. And I didn't want my kids to see it or my mom to see it. It sounds so crazy. And then I remember I was driving a week later, just driving to drop my daughter off at elementary school at the time. It was a long time ago. And this little 25-year-old gal says, she must have been like a student aide or something. She's like, oh, Mr. O'Neill, why are you here? And I was just like, you know? And so my daughter gets out of the car, and I'm driving, and I'm like, I'm actually processing it. I'm literally saying to myself, like, are you serious? Are you really insecure? You're just running Madison Square Garden. It's like a dream for a New York kid. You ran for 4 years. That's unbelievable. And now it's over. Buck up, kid, you know? It was like moments like that I've had where, like, you know, there's times on social media where I am like a pinata, okay? And you'd think you'd be like, Sky, he's fine, right? It actually hurts. Like, and I'm surprised and disappointed at myself that I'm not strong enough to like, no, I'm not gonna read my mentions. I don't really care. It's a bunch of crazy fans. No, it doesn't really matter to me. It's X. Like, I'm disappointed in myself. So I understand what that is and what it means. The people that know me and love me will tell you, like, I am vulnerable. Like, they know, they see me cry. You know, almost everybody that loves me see me cry. I've cried giving a talk. I've cried, you know, at my daughter's baptism. I've cried, like, I'm, you know, people have seen that side of me. I'm much more comfortable walking in the shoes telling you about where I fell down than where I succeeded. It's just kind of, so it's a very much, much more comfortable space for me. But as for the crap I'll take, you know, it can't be any worse than what I've seen. And that's okay. You know, when you do something to help people, I hope this impacts some people. I remember my wife and I did this video. It was for our church, and, you know, and faith stuff is hard for people to take in because they see you and, you know, I told you, like, separate religion and politics. And we'd done a kind of a pro-faith video for a good friend of ours who wanted to leverage it and spread the word and blah, blah, blah. And so we did the thing. And I remember we got a lot of positive feedback on it from a lot of people. And I remember this one woman came up to my wife and said, "Are you Lisa O'Neill?" She said, "Yes." And she just hugged her, started crying. She said, "Well, I just want to tell you that video, blah, blah." So I was like, we had those kind of moments. And then there was this one guy I was picking my daughters up. They were seeing the piano guys, like these two like piano players. They tour. My kids love them. So I was picking. I didn't go. I went to a hockey game and met them afterwards to pick them up at the NJ Pack, this big theater in Newark, New Jersey. So I went to go pick them up, and I saw a guy outside who I knew, and he said to me, "Yeah, I saw your video. Of course you did that. Of course you'd leverage." You know. And I was kind of like, you know. And so you're going to get it. Like, if you put yourself out there today, you put yourself out there. Like, you decide, like, hey, you know what? I'm going to help people become better leaders. You know, and there's someone out there saying, he's full of crap. Like, I don't believe what he said, or I don't like what he said, or maybe you get like a shot here or there, and it stinks. And it's like, I'd love, like Vince Lombardi used to say, like the man in the arena. Like, you're in your arena right now doing your thing. Like, I want to be in the game. I've always been in the game my whole life. And when you're in the game, you're going to get kicked in the teeth sometimes. And that's okay. But, like, if you want to win and impact people and influence the world and leave the world better than you found it and make a dent and maybe move somebody, you know, you're going to have to put it out there. And we did. And I hope it does just that.
Yeah, I think the more you do it, too, the more you start to realize the important part of this, which is that if someone is attempting to kick you in the teeth, but they're not even in the game to begin with, to be able to let that, you know, roll off the back, like the guy who called you out when you were picking your daughters up, you know, there are people who could have said that to you where maybe you carry it with you for months afterwards, or that was like it hurt more because of who they are. When someone's not even in the game to begin with, a lot of times their goal is just to take people out of the game because they're jealous they're not in it. And so I think the more we do that, the more we get better at kind of looking at ourselves and saying, wait a minute, this person's opinion does not matter. Like, why am I dwelling on this at all?
But the fact that I recalled it, just with you asking the question, is pretty scary. Like,
yes,
it shows you, like, the psyche is, we have to manage this thing up here. You know, it's not just a hat rack, as I like to say.
Yep.
You know, I mean, we actually have to manage our thoughts. And we have to manage how we see the world. And we have to compartmentalize the one and say, like, yeah, okay, not working for you, but maybe worked for 1,000 other over here. And that's life. And I want to play in it.
I actually watched your video that you were talking about a few weeks ago. And the takeaway that I got from it was the impetus for this question to you. Because the first thing I thought was, wow, here's a person who is a public figure talking about religion from a really vulnerable standpoint, and you know, the journey that you've taken in with your faith and with your family and everything like that. And that's the takeaway that I got was, wow, I can't believe that he was okay with doing this from a good way. Like, there's more people should do that, and the more people that do it, I think the more normalized it'll become.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I've spent my life following my heart. I have, and my instincts, and but it doesn't always. I mean, I'm like everyone else in the world. I'm doing the best I can every day to try to make it better, and for myself, for my family, for the world, for my company, for the people I love, for my friends, for my community. And sometimes it really works, and sometimes it really doesn't. And we have this in the book. We talk about this concept, which I stole from Indra Nooyi's father, who was the former CEO of Pepsi. Assume positive intent, API. And so if you came to my house, it's actually chiseled in slate over our door. So the last thing my kids see before they leave the house is API, assume positive intent. And that's what I hope people assume. When I'm doing a video for my church, or, you know, doing this podcast, you're like, oh, this guy's a leader. Or, you know, my kids, one takes the other's shirt and they're arguing over a shirt, you know? And I'm like, assume positive intent. You know, just assume that the person is full of love and goodness and needs a hand and is trying to help and is trying to make a difference. And in my kid's shirt case, assume the kid was struggling that day and she needed a shirt and she felt good about your shirt. Okay. And that caused less chaos in our morning, that now you're ramping back up. So I think that's the notion of assuming positive intent. The world would be better if we did better at that. And I think, For me, that's like that's a guiding principle when I'm starting to feel angst towards somebody or judgmental towards somebody, or you know I say, okay, can I assume positive intent? Can I give every interaction we have a fresh start? It's probably a better way to say it.
Oh yeah, that's awesome. I think we need to get better at doing that as a society. I think individuals are good at that. I think as a group we devolve and we become very poor at that. You took over as CEO of the 76ers at the beginning of a very complex time, an incredibly complex time for the organization. I'll put that lightly. Was there any point in 2013, 2014 where you felt like you were in over your head? And
every day.
Yeah, every day.
Every freaking day.
What was there a light bulb moment or something that happened that changed that, where you got to the point where you felt like, okay, I'm where I'm supposed to be. I don't have imposter syndrome. I don't have, you know, like I might struggle from day to day on certain things, but I am the right person to do this right now. What happened that brought you there?
Yeah. Well, your questions are always loaded on so many levels. They're fantastic. So you're in the right line of work. So that was a really complicated time. And so for people who don't know, it's generally known as the trust the process era. And the notion was that we walked in and we were at the cap, so we couldn't really spend any more money on players. We had just completed what's arguably the worst trade in history for Andrew Bynum. And the way you reload teams in the NBA, if you don't have any cap space, is through the draft. And we only had two first-round draft picks over the next 5 years. And our business metrics were all in the bottom five. So any KPIs that anybody would care about, we were not hitting the radar. And that's when I entered. And as did Sam Hinkie, who's the general manager and much talked about general manager. Young guy, brilliant guy and good friend. And the notion was that we were going to take a long view. And Sam had two great little anecdotes he used to say. He used to say, if you want to go to the moon, don't bring a ladder, which I love. Okay. And he also said, there's no shortcut to the top, only to the middle. What are you interested in? I love that notion. And so one of our players, Tony Roten, came up with this notion of trust the process, which then became an international, in many cases, misunderstood and misused anecdote. In some ways, for our harshest critics, it was, you're losing on purpose. And for our most ardent supporters, it was, you're taking the long view. And so you're not subjecting yourself to the pressure from the media, from your fans, from your neighbors, from your kids, from whoever else is in that sphere. And you're just going to make the right decision every time. What we thought was the right decision every time. Inevitably, like, you can't make the right decision every time. But with the information we had, we made the right decision every time. And it was, we were under extraordinary pressure. And we went through, I don't know, 70 some odd players. We went through, you know, and some of their careers were made and some of their careers were broken. But we traded, everything was available and kind of in pursuit of these top draft picks, which fast forward, it's easy to say today, Joel Embiid was a number three pick and is an MVP candidate this year. And Ben Simmons was a number one overall pick. And he looks like he's going to be defensive player of the year. They've both been multiple year all-stars. Our team's in first place in the East. And you look now and you're like, oh, of course. Why wouldn't everybody do that? Why wouldn't everybody do that? It's because, like, I couldn't sleep at night. Because I had a staff to worry about. I had a city to worry about. I had the mayor and governor calling, suggesting who we should draft. I mean, it was pressure from the league, my old colleagues, my peers from around the league, my peers in sports. There were people, you know, taking positions on this that were out of the space, that weren't helpful. And so, but the pressure was really, really rough. And we got to the other side. Thank goodness. And it worked out. It wasn't linear. We did plenty of, you know, bad draft picks, bad trades, bad decisions. You know, we said the wrong. I mean, I said several things that I'd like to take back. Several, you know, I had several things written that I'd like to take back. I like big brand stories. When I was with the Knicks, we had Linsanity. You might remember that, with Jeremy Lin went crazy that one time. And we grabbed onto Linsanity, and we never adopted it, but we just amplified it. So trust the process. We never adopted it, but we amplified it. But I can tell you, I've been catcalled in Shanghai, London, Spain, Philly, New York, LA, any Sixers stuff I have on, trust the process, from a fan from Philly. So it definitely became a battling cry, a war cry. And I don't know if it can ever be done again. It's a heavy, heavy lift. It's a heavy lift.
In looking at it from the glasses half full standpoint, you know, I think that the leeway that you were given to be able to do this, to trust the process, is something that maybe would not have been given to a team who wasn't going through so many struggles. So there's kind of like this grace that you were given, where it's like, well, it can't get any worse. So let's see what
they
have to do.
Yes.
What's the alternative? I'm sure there are teams out there who they're kind of stuck in this, almost like in a business standpoint would be, from a business analogy, would be the companies that are making decisions for whatever the stock price is this quarter, next quarter, not 3 years from now. And companies can get into a rut with doing that. And they lose the long game because they're focused on giving the shareholders, you know, a few points of return this quarter. And it's the same thing with this. I mean, are you focused on giving your fans a few points of return this game or this season? Or are you focused on what is the long-term goals of the organization? And a lot of organizations probably don't have that leeway because they're almost too embedded in whatever the process is to take a step back and say, we're going to change some stuff up. We're going to take one step backward because we know that's the only way to take three steps forward. Do you think that these are lessons that you're going to be able to take forward with you as you go that will give you the grace and the leeway to continue this without falling back into that mindset of just, oh, let's focus on the here and now that we're back to being good again?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say there are many factors at play. And so if you start applying trust the process to your life, that's when it gets really interesting. Okay.
Yes.
So trust the process at work. You know, we have a board, we have media, we have the league, we have partners, we have TV partners. I mean, there's a whole bunch of constituents. When you talk about your life and you say, like, okay, how can I trust the process in life? Like, what can I do? Can I have a long-term view on myself? And what does that look like? If you have a long-term view in yourself, your intake, like the sleeve of donuts I ate this morning, probably doesn't go in, right? Do I really need the whole sleeve? Probably not. They were fantastic, by the way. White powdered donuts. That's sweet to my weakness. What am I going to learn? Can I get I remember this podcast. I wish I remembered who said it. But, like, if you got 1% better a day, maybe it was Jay Shetty or somebody. But, like, can you think about the notion of you know, I want to learn about cryptocurrency. I'm actually learning about that right now. Can I get 1% smarter a day? What if I want to learn about mental health challenges? Can I get smarter? How can I take care of my body? What do I want to learn? What do I want to grow on at work? How can I become a better leader manager? How can I become technically more relevant? How can I bring more creativity into the workforce? Like, can you imagine if you just said, okay, I'm gonna do this over 5 years, but you know what today's world is? Can I do it in 5 seconds? What's it gonna look like on Instagram? Hey, let me make this cool TikTok. All that stuff's great, okay? But in terms of like development, like that's when you have to trust the process. That's when you have to have a long-term view. Who do you wanna be in 5 years? Not 5 minutes, 5 years. Can you imagine like a 22-year-old? Remember, my workforce is 27 years old on average. I'm saying now, like 5 years, what do you wanna be? Who do you wanna be? What skills do you need to get there? That's a great question. How can I help you on that journey? But I don't think we're doing a good enough job because we want to watch The Bachelor on TV, or because we want to, follow an influencer, who's famous for a freaking minute,
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I think the notion of trust the process is better when we apply it to our lives. Businesses, of course, you should always take the long view. Like, life is long, world is small. I say that all the time. I truly believe we should take a long view. But personally, I don't think we do it enough.
When you were going through this process in 2013, 14, 15, was there a North Star that you could use to ground yourself when you had a decision that had to be made? And the easy decision was the one that would make you no criticism, but it wouldn't be in spirit of that long view. And you had to kind of look at something and be honest with yourself. It's like, well, if I make this decision, it's not in line with this long view, but it's the easy decision, I can do this. But at the very least, you had to look at yourself in the mirror when you were making that decision. What kind of kept you there?
You know, there were repeatedly times during this period when one of us would go off the reservation, But, whether that had been Sam Hinkie or me, or Chris Heck, who's now our president, Jake Reynolds, so President of the Devils, was running sales, Katie O'Reilly, or Josh Harris, or David Blitzer, or the coach, Brett Brown. And we just kind of took care of each other, And we never were all off the reservation at the same time. And it was nice. Like, we got a meeting, somebody would be like yelling, People would be like, "You okay, Scott?" "No, I'm not okay, because this is okay. Let's go back and talk about what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're going to stick together." Or I remember our coach Brett Brown, our former coach Brett Brown, who I just absolutely adore. He was a wonderful coach and even a better person. And his last game of one of the years, I think we won, 10 games. It's like one game off the all-time record for losses. Can you imagine? And at 82 games. And so I remember him saying, "I'm tired of having all these gypsies in here," meaning we were trading players in and out. I think he had like 45 players over the course of a year, whereas normally you'd have somewhere between 15 and 17. We had 45. So in other words, like, someone would go to the locker room and he'd say, "I need to know who they are." And he said that in press conference. "I'm tired of having this gypsies teams, I'm tired of like not knowing who the guys are in the locker room. Had two new guys come in today." And I remember after the game, I went to his office. I was like, "You okay, coach?" He's like, "I shouldn't have said that, huh?" I'm like, "It's okay. It's okay." And he's like, "I know I shouldn't have said it. I was just so frustrated." I was like, "Yeah, you're losing sucks. It sucks the life out of you, right? It's deflating. It's, you know, he's hearing the catcalls. I was getting catcalled at games. I'm like, I'm even coaching the team. He's coaching the team, it was hard. And he folded, whether consciously or unconsciously. Like, and I was just like, and I did the same thing 15 times. I had bad experiences at work. I said the wrong thing to our sales team. I said the wrong thing in the media. I took on the wrong fight. And he would call, say like, "You hanging in there, kid?" And I remember Bill Cunningham, known as Billy Cunningham, former Hall of Fame player for the Sixers and coach for the Sixers. He coached the Dr. J, Moses Malone, Mo Cheeks, Andrew Toney, championship team in 83. He called me one day. We'd lost another game. I think we lost like 28 straight games or some crazy number. And we were on like 25, and he called me late at night and he said, "How are you doing?" I was like, "Not great." And he's like, hey, do me a favor. I was like, yeah, anything, whatever you need. He's like, hug your coach tomorrow. And I was like, wow. Now that's a guy who played in this league, coached in the league, was a general manager in the league, all at a Hall of Fame level. Everything he touched turned to gold all the time. You know, in life, wonderful guy, on the court, and in business, Midas touch. And like, he took the time to call me and say, go hug your coach. Now those moments I will never forget. Like the people that were there, like when it was dark, 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 dark hours. He's like, hug. I was like, wow. And I did. Next day I went in, hugged him. I said, hey, that's from Bill Cunningham. And he said, I needed that. Should I call him? I was like, I think that might be good. And so we helped each other. And you know, and that is life. And that is awesome. And that is friendship and perseverance and resilience. And you need a team. Like, if there's one thing I learned during that time is you can't do it alone. And when I say it, I mean anything. You know, we're just all connected. And this is great ecosystem in life and in work and community and your family. And, you know, as my wife says, it's Team O'Neill when things are going south. I was like, you got it, Team O'Neill. And you got to find your team. And that team, you have 10 different teams, but you got to have them.
I love it. I think it's fantastic. I could literally do this for the next 2.5 hours. This is already about 20 or 30 minutes longer than I promised you and your people that it would go. But I would do this all day, but I really appreciate your time with us today. Would you give us, an ask to our listeners, you know, where should they go to pick up your book? It came out yesterday and, I'm hoping people can find it wherever they want to, but you know, is there a preference for you?
Yes. Amazon, Barnes and Noble, any indie stores. I love supporting local businesses and small businesses. So the extent you have a local bookstore in your market, swing by, be where your feet are. If you could buy a book for yourself and one for your friend, I would be eternally grateful. I think you will love it. I hope you get a lot out of it. And I wish you health, love, and success.
Thank you so much for your time today, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. It was wonderful.